Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're back here. It is 7 p.m. roughly Pacific time, my time, and I'm back with another episode of Gentleman's World. I actually recorded this one twice because I wanted to make sure I covered the right topic, and I wasn't satisfied necessarily with the flow of the topic, but something hit me based on some conversations I was having. And on the previous episode, I was talking about where I've been and where I've gone and what I've been trying to do, and it caused me to reflect a little bit further on what got me to this point. And I was having a conversation with a couple people who were just asking the question, and it's always the same question, and that's part of my frustration. Whenever we're dealing with employment or a contract or anything else, there's just this desire to do the same thing over and over again. Like if you're doing, let's say, contract W-2 as an example, I talked about the fact that they treat it like they're an employee, and they shouldn't, because it's a contractor. A contractor works for themselves, ultimately. Contract W-2 does give you a little bit of flexibility, but at the end of the day, that person doesn't work for you, and they don't answer to you, and they can leave whenever they feel like it, with or without notice, right? And there's a contract, and the contract should be 50-50, and a lot of companies don't do 50-50, and we know all this. Then when it's a full-time employee, it's always the same thing, right? We're going to have some HR person do a screen, and most of them, they're not all, but the vast majority of them, they do the same thing. You know, well, what are you doing right now? And what are you working right now? And how much do you make right now? Because they're trying to dig in your business when it's none of their business. Instead of, let's learn about this person coming in so we can see how he or she adds value to our organization. That's never the cadence in HR. And so I always get frustrated when I hear the stories about the same old questions. They're always asking, how much do you make now? Where do you work now? When's the last time you did this? None of that matters specifically on the HR, but none of that matters in general. It's like, let's focus on the here and now. This person's here. Let's identify the value they bring to the organization, which is let's ask questions about the problem we need them to solve for us. At the end of the day, HR is not going to know enough about the need, I think. So when you treat your HR as basically that front line of, let's make sure that this person is available, right? That's a good, fair question. Are you working right now is a fair question, but it's a closed-end question. So you might position it a little bit different and say, in what you're doing right now, is there anything that hinders your ability to, you know, jump to a new opportunity? And if so, what is that, so we can talk it out? Let's say that a person's currently working, and right, and they're interested in a new position. A lot of companies, I've been told directly, they like that. They like where they're able to poach from somewhere else somebody that they really like, as opposed to somebody who's unemployed because, quote, the unemployed are unemployable. I was told that directly in a supervisor meeting. So if we take for granted that most companies like to poach talent from another company, we assume that then they're going to be pretty excited to talk to that person. But what happens if that person is, let's say they're volunteering, or let's say that they're taking care of home. Let's say they're a single parent. Let's say that they're going back to school. Let's say they're doing something that doesn't involve income. Then what does it matter? Why is that so bad? Why is that such a negative? Why do we assume that person cannot work? And here's the problem. If you dig too deep into that, you start potentially getting answers to that question that start violating that person's rights, because you're not supposed to care as an employer that, say, the person just had a kid, right? Or that they're pregnant and about to give birth, because you're freaked out that they're going to need to take time off for maternity leave. So you're freaking out. Why are you freaking out? You're freaking out because you don't really want to give the maternity leave, because you're not willing to hire the staff necessary to make it a non-issue. So HR spends a lot of time today, the vast majority of companies, not all, but the vast majority of companies spend a lot of time spinning wheels around questions and answers that don't really matter in the grand scheme of, can this person solve our business problems? Now, when we talk about their availability, how quickly can they start? Are they going to need to take time off? All these different things. I've worked at organizations where they'll let you take time off whenever you care to, whether it's paid or not. It's a different conversation. But some people, it's an emergency. They don't really, they'll deal with it, right? It's an emergency. I've had situations where somebody, a subordinate of mine, needed to take sudden time off. It was unplanned. And I said, go ahead, I got you covered. And, you know, people were squawking at me saying, hey, where is it? Did she check in? And I'm less worried about it because I know that she'll come back. But at the end of the day, there's kind of this accountability and expectation that people are not taking time off for more than like a day or two because they assume it's abandonment. Well, if somebody's leaving and it's a true emergency, I may not hear from them because of the nature of the emergency, and I'm okay with this, but a lot of companies aren't. So what they do is they'll ask these screening questions at the HR level that are designed to identify the risk of something like that happening, even though such questions may intentionally be, you know, illegal or not appropriate, right? So they ask all these screening questions and really think of what you're doing. You're purposely trying to disqualify somebody. And why does that make sense as a recruiter? Why is your goal to try to disqualify somebody? Why isn't your goal trying to, for every person you talk to, you want to verify their fit, of course. You want to give them enough opportunity to prove that they can add value to you, which means you're trying to qualify them, not disqualify them. From my perspective, that's the right answer. The same applies on the contract 1099, where, and it's 1099, I've given the analogy before. You have a draft in your home. You should be calling me saying, I've got a draft. I need you to solve my draft, and then give me a quote. You're not telling me how to solve it. You're not telling me you want Pella windows. You're not telling me the solution. You're telling me the problem. I'll tell you what I think is the problem, root cause, and then I'll give you a solution, and then I'll give you a quote. You can charge, you can price me out all you care to and compare me against all the peers that you want to find. At the end of the day, I'm here and you got to take into consideration my warranty, my level of support, my availability, quality of the work, any references, etc. But it has nothing to do with Pella windows if I've determined that you don't need windows, and I make that, and I'm pretty confident because I'm the resident expert in that specific field. So it goes there as well. We get this notion where they don't even want to do 1099. They want to bring them as W-2 because they want to try to control them at the end of the day, like an employee. So then you get corp to corp, right? And corp to corp, a lot of these companies treat the corp to corp as if they're essentially borrowing somebody else's employee. Conceptually, that is what you're doing. The problem is that in a corp to corp, the original corp that has the employee, that's who the employee is reporting to. That's who the employee is accountable to. That's who the employee is responsible to. That's who does the insurance. That's who's on the hook if there's some sort of criminal activity or whatever. Not the one who's getting the employee on board. That means that it goes both ways. No, my employee is not going to subject to your rules. They subject to my rules. If you want to review my rules, we can talk about it, and we can talk about any concerns you may have with respect to my rules, but my worker follows my rules, not yours. You are bringing them on essentially as a third party to come and do some work, and you need to define what that work is. This isn't how most of these work in the onboard process. And so I get frustrated every single time I try to onboard any situation where it's either contract or even full-time. It's always the same thing where we can't break this faulty notion. And there's some in the business actually that support it. Well, if that's what they want, if they want to do you an I-9 and you're a 1099, then whatever, do whichever. No, because they don't need it and you have to fight back. But because a lot of the peers in the industry have bowed down, yes, whatever you want, Mr. Customer, now the rest of us are being subject to stupid requirements. But going back to the full-time, in full-time onboarding and screening and hiring process, what companies have done is they put layers of stuff in front of people because they don't really want to talk to people. They don't want to, they basically want perfect. And so they put all these tools in front of screen, things where, you know, their system will flag you as a duplicate. Although this is in direct contradict to any email that says, we'll keep your resume on file and call you, but they flag you as duplicate purposely. So it'll delete your message and will not contact you and will not follow up with you. So you send your resume, it goes to black hole. Simply because you applied before. Let's say you did apply before. At whatever time, you're told, okay, you're pricing yourself out. Where it's too high. We can't pay you that. Companies don't want to negotiate. What should happen is, hey, my rate is this. Okay, the most we can offer is this. Okay, that means it's time for us to negotiate because we like you and we like you. I like you too. All right, let's negotiate. Let's sit down and figure out how we can get them to meet halfway, which usually is as simple as, company, you're going to have to let go of some of these things that you say are required that are really nice to have. So let's go through your job description, identify what's a must have and what's a nice to have. Chances are there's something in your must have that's spiking your price because you got to realize certain roles are more expensive than other roles. A Python developer is going to be more expensive than a tier one support person. Somebody who does desktop support is going to be less expensive than somebody who does .NET development, right? Somebody who does architecture, somebody who's DevOps, somebody who's full stack, they're going to be way more expensive than somebody who does desktop support. Here's the thing. If you want your DevOps person installing hardware, that person should be charging you more money. At minimum, they should be charging you the going rate for a DevOps person plus 50% of the going rate of a desktop support. So yeah, you could be somewhere in the neighborhood of 170 grand to 200 grand, but you should be willing to pay it because you're not willing to staff that desktop support person to do desktop support tasks and have your DevOps person focus on DevOps tasks, and then they work together to get things done. No problem. We're all okay with this, but we have to make sure the pay is commensurate with what you're asking. If you're willing to think it different and say, okay, you know what? You're right. Let's get rid of the desktop support component. You're not going to need to do that. You're only going to focus here. All right. Then my rate goes down and we can talk about DevOps salary of somewhere between 120K and 150K. Awesome. Easy. Companies don't want to negotiate. The moment you throw a number, and this is why I don't give numbers, single numbers, unless if I know for a fact that I'm totally confident in the number and I don't care, which happens. I usually don't give a straight number. I'll usually give a range because I'm at that point where I'm like, if I give a number, you turn it down, it's kind of a problem. If I know your range, then I'll already have a sense whether it's a waste of time or not. Sometimes I get a range that I'm told for a position. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm way below that, right? And it's my top number as a full-time under the assumptions of the role. Great. And I expect you to pay within your range, not pay what I ask. I'll still take what I ask, but I'm expecting I'm going to be getting raises up to your range. But sometimes I'll get a role where they'll say, hey, are you willing to do this? I'll do anything you want as long as you pay me what it's worth, what it's really worth. So I get outreaches for like tier one, tier two, tier three, basic support positions. I can do basic support, no problem, as long as I understand the software and the hardware and everything involved. And as long as I have the flexibility to solve those problems, I got no problem doing that work. And I'll change my price accordingly because I know that it's not a high-level role, let's say. No problem. My rate can't represent a high-level rate. It needs to represent what this is. If you're lowballing it, then I got a problem. I had a company once come back, and I just threw out a number. I just said, hey, I don't know what to price this thing, so I'll look at this here, this number here. They came back with an offer for exactly that number. I'm like, well, that's fine. However, your start date's 5 weeks out. That means I'm essentially losing money because I'm not getting paid for that 5 weeks period of time. So would you mind bumping up that pay a little bit to offset the money that I'm going to be losing, that I'm not going to get, by like a dollar or two per hour? And they just shut it down. And this dude, who I'm not going to judge him based on his vocal inflection, but let's just say he had some issues. He comes back and he's having an issue about this is higher than what we normally ask. Okay, well, that means you're underpricing the role because based on what you're asking, these guys were asking for certifications. We're talking CCNA and all sorts of stuff. I don't have CCNA because I didn't need it. I'm willing to get it, but I don't have it. There was just no reason to. I've never worked as network admin. So if I'm not working network admin, there's no reason for a network administrator or network associate certificate. I do have Network Plus. Network Plus is fundamental and it covers the basics and you can learn the rest, which is what I offered. If you're willing to do that, great. But I'm assuming a start time that's roughly within a week or 2 weeks so we can kind of hit the ground running, not 5 weeks out. 5 weeks out means I'm already losing like $1,000 off scratch. That's not going to work. And for this role, it would have been like $2,000 or $3,000. So I'm just saying, okay, well then bump the rate up like a dollar or two and we're good. Let's get this rolling. And they just shot it down. No negotiation, no willingness to say, okay, let's see how we can get that start date crunched, or let's go ahead and give you the extra money because we understand what you're saying. You're going to be waiting a long time for this thing. From the offer to the start's 5 weeks, a long freaking time. I've dealt with programs where you don't get paid for like 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks. It's not fun. It's not. I wouldn't have had to do anything except they're going to require that I do all their initial screens and all this other stuff. Now I'm spending money. Because I have to go places, I have to do things, I have to get notaries, I have to do all this stuff, I'm spending money. And what I've learned is to stop doing that, is to stop giving away the pony. If they're not willing to come out of pocket for some of that stuff, no. Now, if they're willing to pay me what I want, I have little issue about it. I still will complain a little bit, but I'll eventually do it. I'm talking about where I've compromised on the pay. And in exchange, I'm assuming that you're going to expedite the process and streamline it and get us to meet me halfway. Get us to that point where we can start adding value. If they're not willing to do it, that's their prerogative, but then I'm going to ask for more money because you're costing me money. And it seems like a lot of companies don't want to incur that expense. I don't blame them, but at the end of the day, it has to be negotiation. It's got to be 50-50. It can't be me just give. And I'm supposed to be just satisfied with the fact that eventually I'll get some sort of a check of some amount that I may not be satisfied with. Because think about it. If you pay somebody lower than what they really are worth, I'm not talking about what you've gone to salary.com and priced the role as. I'm saying what that person's worth, what their time is worth, what their skill is worth. If you've lowballed that role, that person is not going to be satisfied. That person is not going to stay. Attrition is very expensive. Turnover is very expensive. Hiring is very expensive. Onboarding is very expensive. I speak from experience as a business owner myself. So what I'd rather see is that we offer people what they're actually worth, as opposed to trying to lowball them on upfront. And that means negotiating, because we don't have to give away the pony. We just have to then simplify our requirements to make it make sense. Whatever they're asking has to make sense. We want to make sure they're taken care of. The second part of this is that there's a resistance to pay people based on where they live. We want to pay people based on where your office is. I think we should pay people based on what the value of that person is, regardless of where they sit, regardless of where you sit. Think about it. If I choose to live in Montana, like Corey lives in Montana, and that was a shocker to me, and I'll tell you a story about that another time, because I've been to Montana. It's a nice place. So if I choose to live in Montana and the house is $110,000 and I'm asking $120,000 a salary, you shouldn't come back with a salary offer of $75,000 because you did some salary.com quote and it came back as the median. No, I said I want 120 because that's what I want. Yes, I want enough that I could buy a house in 1 year. It doesn't matter that the fact that I'm there. I could move to another place, Nashville, Tennessee. I could go there and buy a house for $80,000. I might ask you for $100,000. You shouldn't care because you're valuing me at $100,000. In my case, I've flattened the salary. I've said, this is what I want if I'm full-time. This is what I want if I'm contract, to keep it simple. Because the only exception would be if it's a contract and you want me to relocate to a place that's nonsense in how much it costs, then I'm going to do a cost of living calculation. I have a spreadsheet that does this. So like Boston, for example, is an absolute joke. They basically, for me to survive, I'd have to charge somebody $500,000. For me to comfortably survive, that's ridiculous, because it's all based on a situation where you have dual incomes. I don't have dual income. So when we do this, when we do this conversation and there's no desire to negotiate, it's this or the highway. They're doing that because they know that it's a rat race and there's a whole bunch of people out there squirming for a job because our administration has basically caused this because of this whole nonsense of jab or job, and people have been laid off and cut and fired, and then there's all sorts of flack, and then people catch whatever disease is, and it's a whole nightmare that's self-inflicted. So now we have to kind of reset. We have to rethink it. This is what I want. I'm giving you my wish list. We have to rethink it. We have to start from square one and think about what's the problem we need solved. What value can this person that I'm talking to add to this company? And yes, some of that goes to how well they can communicate. Some of that goes to how well they carry themselves in an interview. Are they on time? Are they, cordial? You don't have to be smiles all the time, but you do have to be cordial and respectful and mindful. You did a little bit of research at some point about the company. You know kind of the conceptions of what we're talking about with what we need. But it's also on the employer to get better at streamlining the hiring process, the screening process, and the review process. Because what we get is you get a whole bunch of people applying. They go to an ATS, which is an applicant tracking system, Workday or iSIMS or whatever. You do all this application. You spend 10 to 30 minutes, depending on how onerous it is, filling out all this data to data enter into the application because they don't want to hire a data entry person. Then you wait potentially up to a week, maybe more, before anybody gets to your actual thing. And that's assuming you didn't get filtered out by poorly built rules in the system. Then some initial screener gives you a call, and usually they're a once and done. If there's some issue trying to reach you, let's say your phone was out of battery or something happened, something went wrong, which is why I like landlines. Something goes wrong, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, too bad. And why? Why are you doing that? And the excuse is, well, we got thousands of resumes. Well, you have thousands of resumes because your job description isn't built to properly filter them correctly. And the way that you do the outreach is designed to cause people to get frustrated and just apply when they're not really qualified because there's too much to it. Okay. So then assuming you get a call, you get to talk to them and it's the same old questions. What are you doing right now? How much do you make right now? Same old questions, same old boring questions. We don't dig into, I want to learn about you. I want to learn about the kind of person you are. I want to learn about your work ethic. I want to learn about the kinds of things you like to do in the workplace. I have one that actually asked, tell me about the work environments you do and don't enjoy. I like that question because I'll straight tell you, open floor plan ain't going to work for me, brother. So I like creative questions that actually care about the individual, not questions that are just generic template that you were taught in human resources management in college, because I know that's where they're coming from. At some point, some of those questions might be of value, but I don't think they should be the first questions you hit people with. I think you should start with learning about the person, treat it like an informal conversation. Just make sure you stay away from certain questions that are inappropriate. You know, are you married? Do you have kids? To me, those are inappropriate. I've been in screening where they've talked about that. I've been in trainings where they've talked about that, and some people willingly give, and I risk they wouldn't because I think you're putting yourself in a vulnerable position. Regardless, let's assume you get past that HR person, which most people don't, but let's assume you do. And you get to, in this case, the hiring manager, usually is the next person up. The hiring manager, that person should know the boundaries of the job description to be able to screen you effectively, to be able to say whether you are a fit to potentially move forward in this role. What tends to happen is that hiring manager in their mind is looking for somebody that's just like somebody who was just in that chair before you, and they're not really being fair and unbiased. You know, it reminds me of a song from old days. I don't know if anybody remembers the song, but I want to help remind you if you don't. I want a girl just like a girl that married dear old dad. Same thing. Just get somebody in that's just like the person that left that chair. It's frustrating. It's annoying because we know that's what they're doing based on the questions that they're asking. The questions that they're asking feel like it's like you're trying to make sure that I'm just like who left. And that's what we should not want. Or the questions that we're asking, and usually this is HR, but the questions that we're asking are designed to make sure that we fit into the groupthink, the echo chamber, the good boys club, that we're going to be a fun person or we're funny. Speaking of funny, I had one that specifically had on the job posting. Need to have a good sense of humor. What does that mean? Because if we think about it, we know that there's multiple definitions of senses of humor. There's the Jim Carrey type of sense of humor. I don't find him funny at all. There's the Kevin Hart type sense of humor. He's slightly funny, but he's not my type of funny personally. There's the Dave Chappelle type funny. He I find funny, but not all the time, but he certainly has his moments. DC Curry is funny. I would argue he's more funny than Dave Chappelle ever slightly. Bernie Mac, may he rest in peace. I thought it was absolutely hilarious almost all the time. So there's levels to what is sense of humor. There's dry sense of humor. There's slapstick. What are we talking about? Then there are people that do offensive humor that some people might be okay with because they don't take it personally. And some people might be offended. So you never know. You actually could be introducing risk by saying we want somebody with a sense of humor. How come people can't just be themselves, whether they have a sense of humor or not? Because at the end of the day, what should matter, I think, is that you're able to come in and fulfill our business need, solve our business problems, add value to the company. At the end of the day, those are the key things I think any company should care about. We've gotten to a world, though, where there's excessive focus on the idea of, quote, culture. Culture is not something that you create. Culture is something that you cultivate. Thus, the term culture, cultivate. That's what should be the case. Instead, we're trying to force a culture. We're trying to dictate a culture. And then we're trying to exclude people that don't explicitly fit within the confines of the culture we have created. Instead of enabling people to create a culture of its own by saying, this is our policy. This is how we behave as a company. We don't tolerate this. We allow this. We accept this. We like this. We dislike this. Just define it in policy. But we should embrace all different sorts of disparate ideas and disparate opinions and disparate suggestions and disparate work styles, diverse people that come in that are not like you, that don't talk like you, that don't explain things like you do, that don't necessarily smile all the time, but they're powerful workers. They're people that you can, you know, that if you give them tasks, they're going to get it done early every single time, that you can rely on and get the work consistently. And we should look at those people as our future leaders. Why? Because we've kind of veered away from developing leaders, strong leaders, as opposed to fun leaders. All of this is what I believe. I believe that we've gone the wrong direction in how we screen, how we onboard, how we hire, how we review, how we elevate, how we develop, how we promote culture. I think that we do it wrong. As opposed to us focusing on the people we like, we should ideally focus on the people who are effective. I don't know why we veered away from the idea that people that are effective are not what we want. I don't know when we decided that effectiveness is the secondary priority and niceness is the first, or people who are happy hour, or people who smile, or people who laugh, or whatever is the top, or people who hang out at cubicles and laugh and giggle and joke is what we really want. I mean, think about it. If we're in a if we were in a world that did not have Zoom, right? Zoom, Teams, WebEx, we don't have any of these video type tools. At the time, we were still doing conference calls on the phone. Some people still do them, believe it or not. We didn't need to see people. We didn't need to see if they were smiling. We might crack a joke, not really being serious about it. But generally speaking, we're down to business and we focused on the time aspects of getting through the meeting efficiently, right? Because we need to get back to the work. When video started to be introduced and we started to break down the cubicle walls and we started to focus more in a direction that said, we want to have a culture that is XYZ, I think that's where things went south. And to me, that starts at the beginning. It starts with the hiring process and how we screen and how we recruit and how we identify people to fit the job. And I don't think we do a good enough job personally of identifying the right people for the job. That means, in my mind, when I say right people for the job, I'm talking about people who fit that job description, not necessarily even perfectly, but the job description is your go-to to define who should best fit in that chair. Yes, you're going to come across those situations where you got two or three or four candidates who all could be a fit. Then you have to get creative. Then you have to identify other opportunities to potentially screen to get down to that right candidate by way of the potential. Potential is something you can't measure. It's something organic. Your tools, your automated tools can't find it for you. You as a human have to really think and talk and really process what they're saying. This requires skills that I don't think we use today. You have to really understand the person and really take the time to dig in and figure out what is it about this person that's going to tell me today that they are going to excel, not just today, but in the future, right? Potential. When you try to gauge potential from candidate A to candidate B, I guarantee you, you're going to find a really clear split. When I was doing screening for a position that I was hiring for, I had two. I only initially planned to have one, and in hindsight, I should have stuck with that. But I decided to build two, and I was screening four people for this role. There technically was five, but one dropped early. I was screening four people for this role. As I got down to the four, one of them was a flawless, perfect, I thought he would have been a perfect fit for the role. However, I thought he was an even better perfect fit for a different variation of that same role. Because the way I did the role was, this one over here is going to be sales. This one over here is not sales. They have the same base. This sales one has more profit potential, but you still got the same base. The only thing I ask of you is to close one deal. That's it. And then you'll be able to keep the base and you'll make the commission. And you'll have standards for the commission ongoing. He would have been perfect for that second because he had sales experience. He had done it before. He seemed like he had flow. His communication was really good and he had a charm about him. There was something about him where I could picture him walking into any building and immediately charming the receptionist off her feet or his feet and getting in front of the big wigs to close deals very easy. I knew he had it in him. He just needed to be refined a little bit in the messaging and learning of the products and everything, which is my job. So I present him, I'd like you to be on the sales side. If you're willing, I'm willing to give you an offer right now. He says, well, I don't really want to do that. Tell me why. Well, I don't really want to do sales. I just want to make a base salary. This disappointed me because it told me that he didn't want to push himself. He didn't want to push himself to that next level and take the feedback I'm giving him that I see there's more out of him where he's got infinite profit potential. This dude easily would have closed. somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 a month. Once we got full steam, he had it. I knew he had it, and he didn't want it. So he wants this lower-level position. Okay, and I told him straight up, okay, then I'll add you to consideration for that role. But I already knew in my head I wasn't going to hire him because he didn't want it. The person that I eventually hired in that position, he told me, yes, I don't mind doing the sales, but initially I got to get used to it. I got to kind of work. We got to work together to learn the products. And other. Yes, that's cool. We're going to take the time to do that. I brought him in, and unfortunately, he wasn't able to keep up necessarily with the velocity I needed him to do in the sales role. The thing is, he was very good at the non-sales functions, but it was kind of beneath him, as in he was so far above it from a potential perspective for that role, and he was not really pushing himself on the sales side, even though I knew he had it too. He had the same charm, same look, same gift that I saw from the other guy. Now, I had to make a choice, and then there was the other guy, and I was going to hire him, but then he said something about the other potential new team partners that he was going to have, and that statement told me he was never going to fit in a team. Well, that was not going to work, so he essentially disqualified himself. I didn't want to do that because I thought he was very solid, but I can't have somebody who's going to be disruptive to the team, and he basically admitted he would be disruptive to the team. So now, for me, yes, it's difficult because I got now basically two candidates. This other guy that I know is good at sales but doesn't want to do it. This guy that's fine doing sales, but he's not really excelling at it, as far as I could tell. And I chose the second one because I figured, okay, I can work with him over time. He wants to do it, and that's where I want him to be, and I could just build him up to this. That turned out to be a mistake, but regardless, I was able to make the decision by just readjusting. Because if everything's the same in terms of background, you know, we're talking the similar background, similar college education, similar everything else. They interviewed well both sides. Everything was pretty clean. All that was really the differentiator is motivation, potential. Can I build this person to where I want them to be? Can I develop them? And am I willing to do it because I see the energy's there and I just have to manipulate the energy to that direction? And in those cases, one had it, one didn't. Well, that made the decision for me. Didn't mean the other one's not a good candidate and didn't mean it wasn't somebody I was willing to hire, but I chose a different candidate for the role that was not sales because that candidate interviewed way better than this person by far and away. She asked the right questions. She asked about the business. She asked about challenges with the business. She dug in deeper than any candidate I'd ever interviewed, and I was very impressed with the way she interviewed. Sometimes it's as simple as that. Sometimes it's as easy as saying, who is it that you have that raw potential? You believe that this person can be something. And it just takes kind of sitting and working with them and mentoring them to where you need them to be. Because a lot of companies, I think, have gone away from mentoring, I think that's a byproduct to what we see now in the hiring and screening process, where now our goal is to disqualify people because we're looking for people who already are the superstars, who are the excellence of execution, who are perfect in every single way. Those people are going to be more expensive, and those people are more likely to leave when they're not satisfied. It doesn't mean you don't hire them if there's an opportunity and they're the best fit and nobody else comes close. What I'm saying is you got to be realistic. Those people are most likely to leave. That means you got to work harder to keep them. That means that you got to pay more to keep them and retain them. They've got to be satisfied. And I think a lot of companies are not willing to do what's necessary to retain the solid talent that they've been seeking so much. So then they get in the spin cycle of can't find the workers we need, when the truth is you could, but you have to be willing to let go a little bit. You have to be willing to settle a little bit. And most importantly, you got to be willing to negotiate, because sometimes you'll find somebody who's not a perfect fit, but they're a good fit. And you just got to negotiate with them to get them on board and then be willing to train and mentor them up to what you need them to be and then let them run to the races. So that's my thoughts, right? I think everything we're seeing in the hiring and screening process, the chaos that it is a byproduct of a resistance to train, a resistance to mentor, which we've delegated to colleges who do a terrible job at it because it's not their job. Their job is to give core education, fundamentally, and then certain targeted education pieces on top of the core. I think it's the employer's job to mentor, train, and develop workers into what they need them to be. Finding those workers is finding potential. Finding somebody who interviews well. Some people don't interview well, period. They just don't. To me, those people, they're going to always have a hard time. It doesn't mean they're going to stop trying, and they shouldn't. Because sometimes the company doesn't care that you don't interview well because the nature of the work doesn't require the interview be that good. You just need to make sure that they're available and that they seem like they're on the right page. That's good enough. Cool. I've had companies where they'll hire everybody. They don't care. Literally. They don't drug screen. They don't do anything. And when can you start? And they'll ship you hardware and the whole nine. And they really don't care how you interview. It's a group type thing. There are some of those. They pay lower. But it's, you know, it's livable. I wouldn't say it's great wage, but it's livable at least. There's companies out there like that that I would refer people to. If I see that, hey, you don't ever well, you just need a little bit of money right now to get you by, there's opportunities out there that'll do that. There's some that, like Arise, I think it's garbage, but it will meet the need if all you need is cash and you're willing to take a bunch of abuse because, frankly, their training is garbage. But there's companies like that out there. There's companies, numerous companies I can think of that do call center, and they don't have very much requirements in front of the call center, especially during seasonal, like for go-to-school season, or some companies are just year-round as they grow, and it's mostly customer service for sales positions. So there's some of those. There's working for yourself, which is harder, of course, but there's opportunities to do that. So if you're the kind that doesn't interview well, maybe those are the start points. And as you get into those, then you can work to practice the interview skills. Because I think interview skills develop over time. The main thing that about interview is simply don't offer too much, but be honest. I just think that companies have gone too far in the expectation beyond that. You can be a perfect interview candidate. And they'll tell you you're a perfect interview candidate, but they'll still choose somebody else because we see this shiny degree from Harvard. That's all they see. That person has no work experience. They don't know what the heck they're doing in a real-world scenario. And they're just lowballing on the rate, so their price is really low, so their salary ask is low because they're fresh out of college, and so that person gets a job because their price is low, and they got this beautiful degree, but they're not going to be able to show up at the job. And because the company doesn't want to train a mentor, the company gets frustrated because that person is not able to keep speed. Now, I've met people who have interned at companies, and I've helped interns kind of in their development at least a little bit. So I know that there's some that can do that and excel. And that person that I'm thinking of, he excelled. He's up doing big things. But I would argue that it's hard for that to happen. There was another young lady that I used to work with. I didn't directly work with her internship, but she interned at the company at the same time. She went on to bigger, better things. It's the exception to the rule sometimes because it doesn't guarantee that's going to happen. Plus, it depends on the company. It depends on the internship. Depends on the college. Depends on the person, right? Do they have that motivation? Not every person has that motivation. Not every person had the opportunity to go to college, frankly. I would rather see if you had the opportunity to work your way up and you have some work experience and I can develop the rest, let's see how that goes and give it kick the tires. As long as you're clear about your expectations and your job description is clear and you know that the person does or doesn't meet and you're not going to find somebody who meets 100%, I don't think any person will ever find a 100% match on your job description. Unless you purposely wrote it around somebody you talk to, like a friend of a friend. But other than that, you're going to have people where you're going to need to settle a little bit because, unfortunately, nobody's going to perfectly meet it. Well, how do you settle? You settle by simply focusing on the needs of the role. What is the problem I need this person to solve? And how can I identify the value this person is expected to bring to the company and hold them accountable to that value? They should be able to describe to you the value they bring to that company, whatever that is. You should be willing to develop and mentor that and nurture it to meet your ultimate needs. And as long as all that's true, then it really doesn't matter who you bring in. You could theoretically go through the process, and as soon as you find that superstar, go ahead and give them an offer. You can sit and wait and spin wheels for weeks trying to find perfect. And, well, this lady's good, but, you know, let's just keep looking, see what else is out there, which is what a lot of them do. All you're doing is burning money. Because, remember, every last person in that process, you're burning their salary with this search and with this screening and with this reviewing and all this stuff. You're burning money. All because you're not satisfied. And you're not satisfied because you're trying to find somebody to replace who was in that chair last. Usually when it's a smaller company, we don't see this as much. When it's larger companies where there's a lot more money to be spent, we see this an awful lot, and it's unfortunate. I don't want to see that. I want to see that we move forward together with smarter hiring practices, especially now, and we get more creative with how we screen and how we recruit. Now, that said, I want the smoke. I always want the smoke. If anybody in HR can explain to me why we have not changed our recruiting and screening and reviewing process, I would love to hear it. I would love to hear the reason that we refuse to advance our hiring process a little bit more than what we're doing, to where we can skip a lot of the minutiae that we put people through, so that we can identify those stars, so that you can get value out of these people. Because at the end of the day, that's what we should want, is value for our company and doing what's best, so that we're not spending inordinate amounts of money because we can't find the perfect candidate. The perfect candidate is a joke. The perfect candidate is the person that you train to be perfect, but we've lost sight of that. How do we get back to that? I don't have that answer. To me, I think it starts with looking at the hiring process, start to finish. Starting with the ATS and the over-reliance on ATS, blocking people as duplicates, filtering people out, and refusing to embrace people for who they are, what they do, and how it works, so that we can move forward and say, no, this is what we want to do. We want to make this work. We want it to be solid. We want it to be what we need it to be. And in return, we should be able to, as a society, embrace more workers this way, because we should be able to get creative saying, you know what, based on the people we talk to, we're going to need to split this into two jobs. Yes, it costs more money, but we're going to get better quality, we're going to get better value, and our hiring process might get a little bit easier because we can segment certain skills and values separate from other ones, so that when we move it forward, we're not doing the spin cycle of trying to fit square peg round hole.